You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of November, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Jane Kinnamon from Chatham House. Jane, what do you have for us this morning?
More talks with Iran are taking place today in Geneva, and the Iranian foreign minister has said there could even be a deal today. Is that just hype? We'll be discussing it. Meanwhile, claims that Saudi Arabia is lining up plans to buy its own nuclear weapons from Pakistan, and the fallout in the Palestinian territories from reports that Yasser Arafat may have been poisoned.
More from Jane a bit later. The Pakistani Taliban selects a hardline commander as their new leader. We'll ask whether peace talks with the country's government are out of the question.
Plus, it's nine letters and a word game. Any guesses? Well, we are celebrating 100 years of the Nobel crossword.
We'll also head to Finland to hear how the country with the highest coffee consumption in the world is gradually developing a taste for quality mocha, not just lukewarm filter coffee.
I think a lot of it's due simply to availability. 10 years ago, there was nothing on offer. Now we have a couple of local roasteries. We have a few independent coffee shops. It's not much, but it's something. You know, the product is there for those who seek it out.
So all that, plus we'll play some music as well, and we'll have a flick through this morning's North American front pages too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
What may be the most powerful storm to ever make landfall is still battering the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan brought winds of almost 150 miles an hour. Schools and offices have been closed, and up to a million people have been evacuated from their homes. Some coastal villages are now underwater, and mudslides are also feared. Officials have said it could be several days before the full extent of the damage is clear. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is heading to Geneva amid reports a breakthrough is close in talks on Iran's nuclear program. Iran's foreign minister has said a deal could be agreed today, but Israel has warned that would be an historic mistake. Meanwhile, President Obama has told America's NBC network that the US could ease sanctions on Iran if there's a deal, but they must stick to its terms.
We don't have to trust them. What we have to do is to make sure that there is a good deal in place from the perspective of us verifying what they're doing and that they're actually moving in the right direction. We can test it. We don't have to dismantle sanctions to do it.
The Pakistani Taliban is threatening a wave of attacks against the government in revenge for the killing of its leader in a U.S. drone strike. Hardline commander Mullah Fazlullah has been named as Hakimullah Massoud's successor. The group has vowed to target security forces, government installations, political leaders and police. At least two policemen have been killed by suspected militants in Indian-administered Kashmir. They were ambushed as they left work in Awantipura, 20 miles from Srinagar city. There's been an armed insurgency against Indian rule in Kashmir since the late 1980s, but violence has lessened in recent years. A man has been arrested over a series of explosions outside a Chinese Communist Party office. One person died and eight others were injured in Taiyuan in Shaanxi province on Wednesday. Police say a local man has confessed to being behind the blasts. Police found explosives in his home. Germany and Brazil have handed a joint resolution to the UN General Assembly demanding tighter guidelines on internet privacy. Though it doesn't name any specific country, it follows revelations about the extent of US-led spying programs, including claims that the phone calls of the leaders of both Germany and Brazil were intercepted. The resolution says excessive surveillance, data collection, and other invasions of privacy should end. The German government's facing renewed calls for greater transparency after the discovery of more than 1,000 artworks looted by the Nazis. Works by Picasso and Matisse are among the haul found in an apartment in Munich last year. But art historian Jonathan Petropoulos is questioning why it's taking so long to get the works back to their original owners.
Survivors are dying every day. I mean, that generation is still with us, but they won't be for too much longer. And so these delays have real implications. And these are special kinds of objects for these people. And to the extent that we can undertake the restitution of the works that were stolen from Holocaust victims, you know, we should do that as quickly as possible.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. Paul, we'll be back in about 25 minutes from now with another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 11:06 in Doha, 9:06 in Paris, and 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Midori House. Now, time to set the day's news agenda. Today in the studio is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House. Welcome to the program, Jane.
Thank you.
John Kerry, in a bit of a surprise move, he's rescheduled a bit of his program and is now in Geneva for these P5+1 talks with Iran. Could we really be that close, potentially, to a deal?
Well, there's certainly a lot of hype around this. We've heard from the Iranian foreign minister the idea that there could even be some kind of agreement in principle reached today. Now, I don't think anyone's expecting huge substantive breakthroughs, but there may be already some groundwork done to reach some sort of agreement in principle, maybe quite vague, but at least laying out a timeline for an agreement in line with international law within the next 12 months.
Do you have any idea of what this potential deal could be like? You already mentioned it would be something vague.
I think today's statement is likely to be vague and isn't likely to have a specific outline of what the solution would be for Iran's enriched uranium. But we might be going back to the idea that Iran could possess enriched uranium but have it kept outside the country, in Russia or Turkey or something like this. An idea that's been floating around for years, but there wasn't political will for before. Both sides will stress compliance with international law, because for Iran that means it has the right to enrich, whereas for the rest of the world that's also the framework that allows inspections and forbids Iran from having nuclear weapons. Probably the most important signal that will come out will be about the timeline. Both the US and the new Iranian president want to show quick progress before people start getting too cynical about this.
And we've heard that a potential first step, if there indeed is a deal, could be reached within, well, could take place in about 3 months, but the final step kind of within a year from now. Let's play the optimists here in the studio and say a deal is indeed reached. How much could this potentially change the geopolitics of the entire region if suddenly Iran is now back brought into the fold?
It's potentially really far-reaching, but it depends whether there's simply a deal on the nuclear issue or whether there's a broader reset of Iran's relations with the US, because for the past 30-plus years, much of Iran's foreign policy has been about resisting what they see as the American agenda in the region and being at odds with all of the US's allies. So this could affect everything.
And if we move to your second story for today, it's also about nuclear weapons. There's been a BBC investigative report detailing growing reports that Saudi Arabia has reached a deal with Pakistan to obtain nuclear weapons if Iran does.
As you say, it's a directly linked nuclear story. And again, the question here is how much of this is hype. Saudi Arabia used to take the policy that the whole Middle East should be free of nuclear weapons, including Iran and including Israel. But in recent years, that started to be eroded because Saudi officials, pretty much over the last 10 years, have been dropping hints, look, if Iran gets away with this, we're not going to be left alone. We're going to take steps as well. And increasingly, there are claims that it's got some kind of deal with Pakistan, a close ally, which obviously does have nuclear weapons, so that it would be able to draw on Pakistan's nuclear capabilities if it felt it needed to.
But surely it's not as simple as that, is it? The Americans are not potentially just going to stand idly by while, you know, the Saudis and Pakistanis trade nuclear weapons.
It's a really sensitive game for exactly that reason. The Saudis want to send a signal that they've got options and that Iran will face costs and will face power balancing. But at the same time, this could also disrupt the momentum of nuclear talks with Iran, because Iran has always said, why should Israel be able to have nuclear weapons and not us? And the more countries appear to be getting away with it, the more they'll make that claim. We're being discriminated against. The world is unfair specifically to us.
How credible do you think these reports are that there indeed would be some kind of a deal between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan? On today's edition of The Globalist, we spoke to two journalists, the other one from Pakistan, the other one from Saudi Arabia, and basically they both agreed that it's quite hard to believe that there would be a deal in principle, because Pakistan doesn't really seem to have that much reason to give weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Well, they do receive money from Saudi Arabia, and there's quite a close relationship between the leaders of the two countries. I guess the other question is whether Saudi would take this step, which could jeopardize its relationship with the US and jeopardize other kind of regional attempts to discourage non-proliferation. But you do have to ask, if they've been saying this for the past 10 years, maybe they do mean it.
You've brought this story as one of the agenda-setting stories for today. Why do you think it's so important, if indeed this story does prove to be accurate, and if in fact it does take place?
It won't end at Saudi Arabia. The questions that then arise are, who comes next? You might manage to see the other Gulf countries feeling that they would be under a Saudi nuclear umbrella. But then questions would be raised about Egypt, which has always seen itself as the leader of the region, the biggest state, possibly Turkey. And so the question of, you know, can you stop nuclear weapons spreading much further?
Do you think the Americans would allow the Pakistanis to suddenly become this quote-unquote nuclear weapons exporter?
It's clearly something they've been very worried about and wouldn't want to permit. And so it could be a massive problem. On the other hand, the international community didn't want India or Pakistan to become nuclear weapons powers. And once people get these weapons, there's not a whole lot you can do about it.
It's obviously going to be hard to find the final answers and find proof that there is a deal or there isn't a deal. But in the case that there actually is no deal, would there still be in Saudi Arabia's interest to raise concerns and make the world think that, hey, they could actually do that?
You might well see them pursuing a policy of ambiguity. I mean, this is what Israel does officially. It doesn't say whether it does or doesn't have nuclear weapons. Many people have also thought that Iran, rather than getting a clear, obvious nuclear weapon, would keep a kind of ambiguous capability so that people think, oh, it's probably got weapons, but we don't know. And it might be that that's actually the rising trend, that the Saudis too want people to think they might have this in reserve, but not something so obvious that they would be punished for it.
And Jane, finally, we have another story. The mystery surrounding claims that Yasser Arafat was indeed poisoned. No one knows by who. No one's claiming to know by who. How much faith should we put in this report that he indeed possibly was poisoned by polonium?
The allegations seem to be becoming more serious. This was first aired in a report on Al Jazeera, the Qatari-owned channel, which tends to be broadly sympathetic to Hamas. So there was a lot of cynicism that this was really Palestinian internal politics coming up with conspiracy theories. But now we have seen a Swiss scientist's forensic report which says we can't prove that he was poisoned or that polonium was the cause of his death, but there were these very, very high levels of polonium left in his body and on his possessions, very mysteriously.
It is indeed very mysterious. What do you think? What are the consequences of this story?
It raises a lot of pressure on the Palestinian Authority itself, which probably can do very little about it. Many Palestinians will automatically blame Israel, which of course is denying it. But Arafat was pretty much under house arrest. He was confined to his compound. He was surrounded by Palestinian security guards. So the logical implication is if he was poisoned, somebody on the inside must have been involved. And those suspicions are going to be extremely dangerous.
And there really is no way to prove indeed who could have poisoned him, is there?
It's 9 years ago. It's extremely difficult. So you'll probably see conspiracy theories on various sides.
Jane, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for coming on the program and setting the agenda with a great look at some of the top stories from today. Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House.
Coming up, we profile the new leader of the Pakistani Taliban, Mullah Fazlullah. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
It is 16:16 in Taipei, 10:16 in Cairo, and 8:16 here in London. You are listening to Midori House.
Now, the assassination of Hakimullah Massoud laid bare the complex politics between Pakistan and the United States. On the one hand, America killed the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, a militant responsible for thousands of deaths in his native country and hated by most. While on the other hand, they achieved this goal with a drone strike a week after the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif met with President Obama, urging him to end America's use of the deadly unmanned aerial strikes.
The timing of the strike was doubtly unfortunate. Sharif had the day before announced the Taliban's willingness to meet for talks with their leader, now dead. That process has stalled and a new leader has been announced, Mullah Fazlullah. But who is the man who Sharif's administration will have to bargain with? Monocle contributor and Pakistan expert Samira Shackle is here to help us find out. Welcome to the programme.
Hi.
So, what are the basic facts we should know of this new leader, Mullah Fazlullah?
Well, as you said, he's a hardliner, although I'm sort of hesitant to use that word in the context of the Taliban because I don't think any of them are that moderate. But he's sort of came to prominence during the Taliban occupation of the Swat region of Pakistan. So that was a sort of holiday area, and it was occupied by the Taliban from 2007 to 2009, and it was incredibly bloody. And I think what's particularly interesting about that in the context of the talks that you mentioned that have stalled is that in 2009, so Mullah Fazlullah was actually leading this effort to occupy Swat. And in 2009, he signed an agreement with the Pakistan government to... The agreement was that the government would sort of cede control of Swat to the Taliban, to the Mullah Fazlullah, on condition that he sort of didn't stopped attacks on the rest of the country. And he very, very quickly violated that. So I think that was quite a good illustration of the fact that Taliban peace talks are sort of limited use, I think. But yeah, he's got quite a bloody history behind him. But
there were some glimmers of hope when we were talking about peace talks with the Taliban within Pakistan over the last couple of weeks, perhaps a couple of months. Should we just now assume that peace talks are completely off the table and we're back at square one?
Yeah, I think for the time being, I mean, a spokesman said Mullah Fazlullah is not open to talks and has issued a sort of long list of threats about attacks on government, government offices, security services, police, and so on. But yeah, I think also that peace talks have happened before, so that there was sort of signs of hope that they were going to go ahead. But they've happened before, as I said, in 2009 and on other occasions, and they've never really led to lasting peace.
So what are the options the Pakistani government has at the moment and at the same time President Obama?
It's an interesting question, actually. I think no one's quite figured it out. So the options are to keep pursuing peace talks, which is definitely off the table at the moment. But sort of some experts are saying that Mullah Fazlullah might not last that long in the job. He's not actually based on Pakistani soil. He's not from the tribe that dominates the Pakistan Taliban, which might make it difficult for him to retain control. So there is talk of a sort of a rift within the Taliban and maybe a takeover by another leader, the one who was actually Sajna, who they thought was going to take over, who is open to talks. So there's that. There's also the option of a return to military action. I mean, there are many, many troops already committed on the border, Pakistani troops, that is, between Pakistan and Afghanistan. But sort of upping that is another option. But, you know, that's not one that's proved particularly popular with the population.
Do we have a sense whether he dislikes the Pakistanis more or whether he dislikes the Americans more?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's a good point you make, actually, because the Taliban makes a lot of noises about attacking America. And even Hakimullah Massoud, who is the leader, of course, who was assassinated last week, he'd said that even if we have peace talks, we're going to carry on attacking Americans. Now, it's actually quite unusual that they do attack Americans. It's Pakistani civilians who are being killed in their droves. I mean, tens of thousands in the last decade. So at this point, they're talking about attacking the Pakistan government. But I think the message gets quite garbled. Now, this is sort of 50 affiliate groups, and it sort of gets quite confused who the real targets are.
What is interesting is that Mullah Fazlullah is actually based in Afghanistan, not in Pakistan. Do you think that is a factor that should be taken into account?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, of course, he has he's been in Afghanistan since 2009, and he has still coordinated attacks on Pakistani soil since then, including notably in September, a Pakistani army general was assassinated. But I think, as I mentioned, it's lots of different affiliate groups. You have to question how much control can really be held over them from over the border and whether that's going to weaken his position. On the other hand, he's got the strong backing of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Omar, who's sort of head of the Afghan Taliban, reportedly gave his backing to Fazlullah's appointment as well.
And of course, many eyes are being put on Afghanistan. Of course, the Western pullout is supposed to be happening. You know, should the West be concerned that the Taliban could potentially, reform and have a very strong power base in Afghanistan back to kind of pre-2001 levels?
Yeah, I think it is a worry. And always with Pakistan and Afghanistan, it's so closely interlinked. The border between the two countries is the most porous in the world, I think. And so sort of you push the Taliban out of one country, they can just cross over the border and very easily come back in. So I think there is a worry about them regaining a stronghold in Afghanistan. And that's definitely a worry in Pakistan.
That was Samira Shackle. Thank you very much for joining us today.
It is 11:22 in Nairobi and 8:22 here in London. It's time now to speak to our man in Kenya, Tristan McConnell. Good morning, Tristan, and welcome to the program. It's been a couple of days now since the M23 rebels announced that they would be no longer seeking military options. They would indeed be looking at political options instead. Now that we've had a couple of days to, I guess, make this news settle in, should we still be as positive as we were when it was first announced?
I think there's a good ground for being positive when it comes to this particular rebel group, the M23. As you said, they gave up their armed rebellion on Tuesday. We're expecting a peace deal to be signed between M23 leadership and Kinshasa, if not today, in the next couple of days. But certainly the rebels are in a far weaker position, having basically lost militarily. And I think that defeat was sealed with the news that came yesterday that the military leader of the rebels, a guy called Sultani Makenga, has also fled Congo and is, according to Ugandan authorities, in Uganda now. So, yeah, the M23 is finished as a force in eastern Congo. But you're right to have, a degree of skepticism, because they were just the most powerful of many different rebel groups, perhaps as many as about 20 that are still operating in this very mineral-rich, resource-rich part of the country where state control from Kinshasa remains very weak. So I think it's far too early to start talking about, peace in Congo. But when we're talking about the M23 specifically, yes, this is very good news. And that particular danger for civilians, that particular cause of insecurity seems to be finished now.
Looking at the situation with M23, some of the rebels escaped. As you mentioned, they are outside of the borders of Congo. Is there a risk that they will one day return and continue the violence?
I think there is always that risk. The Ugandan authorities say that there are many hundreds of M23 fighters who come across the border, but they say they're disarming them. But I think the bigger picture here really is that M23 was only the latest of a series of armed groups that have been operational in eastern Congo really since the mid-1990s, all of whom have had Rwanda's interests at heart and in many cases have had direct support from Rwanda. So the M23 might be gone, but it's always a possibility that if Rwanda continues to see threats coming from eastern Congo, continues to see, you know, insecurity spilling over from eastern Congo, that they will activate another rebel proxy in eastern Congo. And that's always a possibility until we get some kind of, you know, proper stability emanating from Kinshasa. And that seems very far off.
And Tristan, let's move to another story in your part of the world over there in Kenya. The trial of four people accused of being involved in the attack on Nairobi's Westgate Mall is due to start sometime next week. Obviously, that will be a huge moment in that city. But it looks like there are now rumblings that there perhaps was an official cover-up over the bungled operation.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of disappointment both in the press, also just on the streets here in Nairobi. You know, the Westgate attack and the siege that followed was hugely traumatic for people living in Nairobi and elsewhere for that matter. You know, people from all over the world were caught up in it. And the response has been pretty pathetic. I mean, these four guys who you mentioned who are going to appear in court again next week, I mean, none of them were actually gunmen in the mall. They're just accused of having some connection to the planning of the attack, and we'll see as the judicial process goes on whether that proves to be true. But in the meantime, you know, the president has said that there will be a commission of inquiry. That was almost over a month ago now. He said that and still nothing. There have been all these terrible revelations coming out, particularly in the Kenyan media, to do with, you know, looting, wholesale looting of the mall by the Kenyan army, about, you know, failure to communicate between various security agencies who are active, and indeed sort of friendly fire killing some of the police who were there working supposedly with the army. I mean, it really does look like something went disastrously wrong in the security response to Westgate, and the government is just not responding to those fears. Oh, I say they're not responding, but actually the response seems to be an attempt to shut it all down. There's been a bill before Parliament earlier this week which seems aimed at, you know, suppressing Kenya's free press. I mean, the president's now saying he may not pass the bill, but it's a worrying sign that when the media here in Kenya attempts to hold the leaders to account for something as serious as this terrible tragedy at Westgate, the response is to try and shut them up. And that's very worrying indeed.
Tristan, your third and final story for today is about the recent EU ruling that gay people from African countries with harsh anti-homosexuality laws must be permitted to claim asylum. Looking at this from Africa, what do you think the consequences are going to be like?
Well, I think we might well see a number of asylum claims for a start. You know, there are countries, particularly you know, like Uganda, for example, or Cameroon, where, you know, homosexuality is illegal in many countries across Africa. But in places such as Uganda, they've even considered, you know, imposing the death penalty for homosexuality. Now, that law has not yet been passed, but it's been under discussion for the last couple of years. And there really is a sort of a tendency to sort of cling to certainly, you know, Christian religious notions of morality and use that as a way to bash this kind of minority community. And it's politically a good way to sort of attract support, because, you know, one has to be honest here. You know, the large majority of people in many of these African countries are against homosexuality. But I think this law just once again shows us really the divide between, say, European notions and some African notions of you know, what is acceptable behaviour. And what the EU court is saying here is that, you know, laws that threaten to imprison homosexuals or worse amount to persecution and human rights abuse, and now that's been sort of set in law.
And Tristan, I just have a question which may seem a little silly, but, you know, if this ruling in fact will welcome people, gay people from African countries with asylum cases, how are you EU officials going to, like, what's the proving process here? Are we expecting an influx of people pretending or saying that they're gay even if they aren't, just so they can claim asylum?
Well, there's the rub, yeah. I mean, it's going to be a pretty tricky one to prove, although I think, you know, in some cases, like, for example, the three cases that specifically led to this ruling, they have sort of documented examples of sort of persecution by the state. So being, arrested multiple times, being locked up, they might have evidence of torture and beatings. So I think in some cases, there will be very clear evidence, but clearly, I think, as migrants are eager to get from some poor African countries to the wealthy nations in Europe, we may well see a number of people trying to use this new law as a way to claim false asylum. Yeah.
That was Tristan McConnell in Nairobi. Thank you very much.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll take a look at the US front pages with Monocle's Danny Giacopelli, and we'll also investigate the unknown impact of the Nobel crossword.
But first, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry is heading for Geneva amid reports that a breakthrough is close in talks on Iran's nuclear program. Iran's foreign minister has said a deal could be agreed today. Israel has said that shouldn't happen. They say it would be an historic mistake. What could be the most powerful storm to ever make landfall continues to batter the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan's brought winds of almost 150 miles an hour. Up to a million people have been evacuated, and officials say up to 12 million people are at risk. The Pakistani Taliban's threatened a wave of attacks against the government in revenge for the killing of its leader in a US drone strike. Hardline commander Mullah Fazlullah has been named as Hakimullah Massoud's successor. The group says it'll target police, security forces and political leaders. Palestinian officials have been giving their response in the last few minutes to reports that Yasser Arafat was poisoned. They say they accept the findings of a Swiss report that concluded the late Palestinian leader was likely to have been poisoned with the radioactive agent polonium. And Germany and Brazil have submitted a joint resolution to the UN General Assembly demanding tighter guarantees on internet privacy. It doesn't name any specific country, but follows the revelations about the extent of US-led spying programs, including allegations that the phone calls of the leaders of both Germany and Brazil had been intercepted. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
From London
to Zurich
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Beijing,
nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota.
This is Monocle 24.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It is 10:32 in Beirut, 9:32 in Oslo, and 8:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn. Love them or hate them, the Nobel crossword is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Over the past century, it's become one of the most popular pastimes, commonplace in nearly every newspaper and newsstand.
But did you know that the Nobel crossword has had a more profound impact than you might think, from helping international relations to causing even a labor strike? Well, a new book celebrating all these facets, plus thankfully offering a few tips along the way, is now out, and it's called Two Girls, One on Each Knee, The Puzzling Playful World of the Crossword. We're delighted to say we're joined in the studio by the author of the book, Alan Connor. Alan, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Now, there's a bit of a cryptic crossword in the title of the book, Two Girls, One on Each Knee. It took us a little while to come and get the answer. Of course, it is a patella. But before we get into it, in the book you say cryptic crosswords are perhaps a lot easier than most people think. I'm going to give you one right now and see how you do. This one is... It is exploitation by a commanding officer, mm-hmm. One in sizzling casual wear.
How many letters?
It is 9 letters.
9 letters. So commanding officer is probably CO. You get a lot of little abbreviations in crossword. Exploitation, use. Is CEO in use in there? Gosh, it's
close.
Hard to
it's
do them.
House code. So there is indeed a CEO and a use in there.
Yeah.
But a bit of a tricky one. Why do you think that cryptic crosswords are a lot easier than people think?
Well, I've just proved that they're not by not getting that. In my defence, they're probably easier written down, I think, because you sort of you can start trying to make the letters swim in front of you. But the reason that I claim they're easier, which sort of dumbfounds people when I say it, is that in a straight crossword, where you just get the definition, which is what the original crossword 100 years ago was like, you've just got a definition. So if it says something like flat, four letters, well, it could be even or it could be dull, it could be all sorts of things. With a cryptic crossword, you get the definition is somewhere in this clue, in this crazy bit of language you're looking at. But the rest of the clue is a little recipe for things like CO, commanding officer, that tells you some of the letters in there. So essentially, you're getting two clues in one. Mm. So I certainly do the cryptics quicker than I do the definitional ones.
We need to ask more tips from you a bit later in this interview, but I'd like to continue by talking about English speakers and their fascination with words. I remember when I was coming to London for the first time, I had my travel guide that quite clearly explained that British people in particular love words, and English language has the most words in the world. Do you agree with the British fascination with words?
Yeah, I do. The Oxford English Dictionary is quite they're quite circumspect about the claim that English has the most words in the word world, just because, you know, they're lexicographers and they're very careful people. But I think that it does, and I think it's partly because, you know, Britain's been all around the world plundering from all sorts of different cultures through its history and has brought back all these other languages. So English is really a mix of German and Latin and French and all sorts of other languages. And what that means is that English both has lots of different words to mean any given thing, and that any given word probably means lots of different things. And so it's very easy to mislead people or to do something with the structure of a joke where you're seeming to say something and then you do a surprise. And a crossword clue, a cryptic crossword clue, is really like that. It's leading someone up the garden path and they're being led willingly, and then they have the kind of penny drop moment of like, oh, it was a house coat, I see.
And it will be 100 years next month that the crossword will celebrate its birthday. But it wasn't about 9 years or 10 years later until it really took off and became this huge overnight sensation that it was. What happened between those kind of 9 years, 10 years?
It just sat in this one paper called the New York World, which was a sort of scandalous newspaper in New York. And the Liverpudlian who invented the crossword, Arthur Wynne, was just filling some space in a Christmas edition. And people liked them, and some people got hooked on the one in the world, the New York World. And then 10 years later, Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster, who founded Simon and Schuster, they had a new publishing company. They didn't have any books to publish. One of them went out for dinner with his aunt, Wixie, and said, I don't know, I mean, we need some books, otherwise we're not a proper publishing company. And she said, well, you know, my niece would love a book of crosswords. She's addicted to the ones in the New York World. So then they made this first collection of crosswords in book form. And it was that combined with the kind of faddish nature of the 1920s in America that made it really take off. And it became a whole thing of like, women wore crossword-themed earrings and there were musical reviews on Broadway. The crossword was the thing.
In this book, you also emphasise how important phenomenon crosswords have been and how influential they have been. What do you think? What's the best example of to show the world to explain how important they have been?
I think probably the seriousness with which they were regarded is probably best indicated in the run-up to D-Day, when there was this very, very secret operation that the British Armed Forces were very, very protective of the plans, even though they flew out of Admiralty House one day and landed on the pavement and someone handed them in. But that's another story.
It's another book.
And in the run-up to D-Day, the Telegraph crossword, the word Overlord appeared, which was the code name for the operation. And then the names of all the landing beaches started appearing. And I suppose because crosswords are something where meanings are hidden, the kind of people who are spies, they take crosswords very seriously. They do crosswords, spies in fact and in fiction. So the real-life spies were looking at this Telegraph crossword and couldn't help but think, this is a coded message to the Germans. Mm. Someone, you know, is leaking our plans, and the Germans are somehow getting hold of the Telegraph crossword and looking into it. And so, yeah, they went down and found the setter, and I think he used the expression, they turned me upside down. So, yeah, I suppose it's that sense that there are hidden things going on that that makes Crosswords very, very friendly to spies.
There's also a chapter in the book, bringing it to the present day, of how technology has impacted the noble crossword. Now, of course, there's a plethora of places where you can go online to get your fix of cryptic crosswords, regular crosswords, quick crosswords. How do you think technology has helped evolve crossword from kind of over the last 100 years?
I think... initially it was a product of technology, in that printing technology was getting more sophisticated, and it was possible to kind of do things like grids, and to mass produce puzzles in newspaper form. You know, in that sense the first crossword was an artifact of its time. More recently, I suppose setters, you know, crossword setters for newspapers now all submit digitally, and so they use a piece of software to write their programs. Now that piece of software will also help you work out what an anagram of your answer might be. And I think that's sort of up the game in general, in that, you know, if you're a setter, you see far more options than you might do if you were just using pen and paper. And so you really try and pick the best clue, which is often the one with the kind of wittiest, almost natural sounding surface for these strange little bits of language you see after the clue number. So I think it's definitely made crosswording better for setters and solvers.
And to get back to the beginning, you offer a few tips on how to fill crosswords. And I can't let you leave the studio before you've explained why listening to white noise can help you do a crossword. And secondly, why you should start in the bottom right-hand corner.
Well, the bottom right-hand corner, that's partly, that's based on a theory, which doesn't apply to all setters, that setters will... they fill the grid with the words first, obviously. They might have some clue that they really want to get in and structure the crossword around that, structure the grid around that. But some of them then will write the clues in order, and there's a theory that they might be a bit tired by the time they get to the ones at the bottom of the list, which is the bottom right-hand corner. Also, there aren't that many words which end with certain letters in English. Without wanting to get too technical about it, you'll find that the same sorts of words like Everest and things with lots of E's in will appear more often in the bottom right-hand corner. As for the white noise, well, at the American National Crossword Championship, to make it fair for everyone, for a level playing field, they've all got headphones on as they fill their crosswords, and they play in... A sort of amplified version of the room tone from the UN headquarters in New York, which is just, once you amplify it, it's this kind of white noise. And what it does, I suppose, is it frees you from distractions. It's a bit like a flotation tank or something, and lets you just kind of stare at these letters and try and make them float around to the right answers.
That is absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for this. That was Alan Connor, author of Two Girls, One on Each Knee.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this very short break with a visit to Helsinki. And it indeed is 10:42 in Helsinki, 8:42 here in London. Now we're going to have a preview of this week's edition of The Menu. When it comes to consuming coffee, forget about Italy and France for the time being. It's actually Finland that ranks up as the world's most caffeinated country. That explains why Marcus is so happy and hyper every single morning. Well, on average, Finnish adults drink 4 or 5 cups of coffee a day.
Don't you think it's ironic? I've had like 7 already.
I'm on my first.
But anyhow, the quantity of the coffee consumed in Finland hasn't meant that it has been of high quality. The majority of places only serve filter coffee, and if you are really unlucky, it will be lukewarm. However, a new generation of baristas in Helsinki are trying to change Finnish attitudes to the contents of their cups. Mark Bosworth has been to meet them.
I'm on Freisenkatu, which is where the newest addition to Helsinki's coffee scene has recently opened its doors. And here it is, the Freise Coffee Company. It's on the ground floor of a 1920s apartment building. And when I go inside, up the steps, first thing I see is a lovely red and white tiled floor. Well, the man behind this place is Kalle Freise, who is the 2013 Finnish barista champion. Kalle Freise, of the Freise Coffee Company on Freisenkatu. Surely not a coincidence.
No, definitely not. So the street is named after my forefather, who was a poet born 300 years before me. And then somebody decided to name a street after him in the 1920s. And now I happen to find the only shop that actually has that address, so Fräsenkatu.
And it really is a beautiful, nice, clean space. Why did you decide to open a coffee shop?
Well, it's been a dream ever since I got into coffee. And I felt that a space like this was lacking in Helsinki. Coffee bar with a little different mentality and sort of ideas. So we don't just want to serve coffee, we want to educate people to try new coffees and hold a lot of courses and tastings.
And education really is a key word here, isn't it? It's actually an education centre during the week and only a coffee shop at the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. So we're only open on Saturdays and Sundays for now. I wanted to challenge that mindset that a coffee bar or cafe should be open every day. Why couldn't it be open on Saturday and Sunday only? And then during the week, we could more really focus on the education and help people to be better baristas or make better coffee at home or just get to know more about coffee and taste, I don't know, 10 different coffees side by side, those sort of learning experiences.
Why is education needed in Helsinki of all places? I mean, Finns know their coffee, don't they? They drink tons of the stuff.
I don't know if that really translates to quality, but I think there's a huge potential in this market since Finns drink the most coffee in the world. But most of that is not really that great coffee. And I think we could help so many people to be happier by drinking better coffee.
So how do Finns view their coffee at the moment?
There's a great segment, at least in Helsinki, of people who are getting more and more interested in coffee. Not necessarily coffee aficionados or anything, but just normal people who want to know where their coffee comes from and getting more interested in that. And I think that's a really great sign that it's not just coffee nerds getting interested in coffee now. And we're seeing more and more shops and places that don't just serve coffee, but are putting more effort into serving great coffee.
What is striking here is that there's only space for around 6 to 8 people, and there's just one wooden table in the centre of the room with two wooden benches on either side. It's a very communal style table. Coffee, clearly a social activity for you.
It is. That's what really struck me in the coffee culture in New Zealand, where I was living at the time that I got interested in. And there wasn't really anybody doing that the way, sort of the social way, having one big communal table where you would just suddenly start conversations with other people, which is what I really love in cafes and wanted to create in here. I was a little bit afraid that some Finns might be afraid of that, sitting next to other people, but the results have been really great, actually. We see many people talking with people they didn't know before, maybe sharing coffee or sort of just tasting notes. Oh, I really like this coffee. How do you like yours? So it's been really great so far.
There are now a handful of places in Helsinki that are becoming well known for their coffee. Among them are Good Life Coffee, Johanna Nyström, Kaffa Roastery and Kaavala Savu. Another place dedicated to serving good coffee is Gruppo Coffee, which opened earlier this year. It's got a really relaxed living room feel to it, with a low leather sofa next to a coffee table covered in art magazines. The barista is Kalle Ture. So, Kalle, what's your approach to serving coffee?
I would just like to make a quality cup. The niche I have here is probably in that I represent the best of both worlds, contemporary, lighter roasted single origin coffee from a local roastery and the traditional Italian espresso as well, because there's a lot of demand for that and there aren't really any quality cafes that do the traditional espresso right.
As I mentioned, there's a group of you now trying to change things. Just how much has the coffee culture changed over the last few years?
It's changed quite a bit, slowly but gradually. Still, it's only a tiny percentage of coffee consumers that are actually interested in what their beverage truly tastes like. For most people, it's just fuel to get them through the day.
So what's been the catalyst of change for those who are seeking a better cup?
I think a lot of it's due simply to availability. 10 years ago, there was nothing on offer. Now we have a couple of local roasteries. We have a few independent coffee shops. It's not much, but it's something. You know, the product is there for those who seek it out.
And for those people in Helsinki who do just see a cup of coffee as a way to give them a kickstart through the day, what would you say to them to try and change their mind?
Find a quality coffee shop and just try it out and see how you like it. It's great to see people's faces when, maybe for the first time in their lives, they actually taste a truly great cup of coffee. It's illustrative when people come in, maybe for the first time, and they typically order a latte because they are used to the fact they need to dilute the burnt and bitter espresso with half a liter of milk. And eventually, they start realizing that the underlying espresso actually tastes pretty good. So they move down to maybe double cappuccino, and before you know it, they're drinking a macchiato. What can I say? Give quality a chance.
That was Mark Bosworth's report from Helsinki for this week's edition of The Menu, which premieres tonight at 1900 hours in London, 8 a.m. in Auckland, and 1400 hours in New York City. And of course, Marcus, you are the talented host of that program. What else can we expect if we tune in?
Well, continuing with the coffee theme, we are talking about cooking with coffee, using coffee as an ingredient.
You Finns love the coffee, huh?
Actually, this story is from Italy. Some top chefs over there have had this project of using coffee, actually, you know, a bit more than you normally would when you have your dinner. And also we meet Allegra McEverdy, broadcaster, chef and food writer who's come up with a new book. All that coming up on this week's edition of The Menu.
Excellent stuff. Well, in a moment we'll be flicking through this morning's front pages with Danny Giacopelli. But first, here is Blood Buzz Ohio by The National.
Stand up straight at the foot of your love. I lift my shirt up. I was carried to Ohio in a swarm of bees. I never married.
That was The National with Blood Buzz Ohio.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. Time now to look through this morning's U.S. front pages. We're joined in the studio by Monocle producer Danny Giacopelli. Happy Friday to you, Danny.
You're not even going to ask me about the song.
Are you a fan?
I picked the song, Phil.
All right. But you're not from Ohio.
No, I mean, well actually, they are kind
Maybe
of
Maybe there's
Ohio.
A song called Blood
Ohio via Brooklyn.
Blood Buzz Long Island.
I get it every time I'm in the studio. I can't help where I'm from, Phil.
Well, should we get on to some of the stories you've got? President Christie, is this? Should we be looking forward to President Christie in 2016?
Maybe. What the news here? Yesterday's Time magazine that came out, it had a silhouette of Chris Christie in a kind of Hitchcockian pose.
He's a hefty man.
He is a hefty man. I actually gave you the Time magazine image in the back of that. Essentially, they say the elephant in the room.
I think that's really rude.
So they're making a blatant reference to his heft, as I think you put it.
Do you think that's going to matter when it comes to the elections?
I don't know. I really don't know. We've had some kind of overweight presidents in the past. We've had Taft, which he famously couldn't fit in a bathtub. You know, who knows?
But Taft didn't live in the era of television, did he?
No, yeah, exactly. So it remains to be seen. I don't think it will be a gigantic problem. but, you know, you never know. But weight issues do kind of linger in some people's minds.
Guess it's wait and see.
Yeah, exactly. Shall we continue with talking about someone who's slightly slimmer?
Yeah, very, very slim Edward Snowden. So it seems that he didn't hack or he didn't break into the computers in the Hawaii NSA Center, rather. He was given passwords by his colleagues. So he literally went up and asked for their passwords and usernames, and he that's how he got the classified information that way.
What do you think is worse, hacking and actually stealing it, or getting your colleagues to give you their passwords?
I think it's more embarrassing for the colleagues. I mean, it seems like some of them have been disciplined over this, but it's kind of a funny twist in this story.
And shall we just move on straight away to talk about what's been going on in a publication called Guns and Ammo?
Yeah, so Guns and Ammo, hugely popular gun an ammunition magazine in America. No, but it's actually a very popular magazine. And one of the editors there wrote an op-ed about not all-out regulation on guns at all, but saying that if you want to own a gun, you should go through a training class, essentially, which is kind of a rational, logical thing to do. But of course, he was fired immediately. It was a Twitter outcry. Everybody thought he was, you know, crazy. It really blew up in his face, and which kind of brings to mind the ridiculousness of some people that, you know, all he was suggesting is that they get trained.
Well, what is the latest with a gun legislation in the States? Of course, after Sandy Hook, you know, everyone was saying gun reform.
Yeah, I don't think...
But nothing's happened.
Yeah, right. Nothing really has ever happened. I mean, there have been some reforms in the past, but, you know, semi-automatic weapons and things like that. But yeah, who knows? I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
What's the latest regarding the mysterious barges docked in San Francisco and Maine?
Yeah, so there have been these kind of sci-fi-esque gigantic barges floating off the coasts of America. People speculated they're from Google. They are actually from Google. The Google has come out and said that. Nobody really know what they were for. People said they might be, you know, data centers. They might be doing weird nefarious spying or something. It turns out Google just announced they really don't know what they're for, but they're probably going to be used for some kind of education purposes. But it's still kind of mysterious.
Something else that will be a bit mysterious will be the new Star Wars film, but apparently it's coming out in a couple years.
Yeah, I added this because I thought you guys might be interested in going to the casting call in the UK. They're having an open casting call soon.
Oh.
I don't know if you guys...
Always open
Marcus,
for options.
I could see being a Jedi Knight or something.
I could be Zulu? Is that a Star Wars character or that's Star Trek?
I don't think that's it? Star Wars.
Yeah, sorry.
Amazing. And then your final story for today is about $4 toast.
Yeah, so San Francisco, so toast there and other food is very expensive, apparently. There have been lots of complaints because of the tech scene. Prices have just gone skyrocketing. So there's been this campaign all centered around a $4 piece of toast because some guy went and got breakfast, toast and tea or coffee, and it cost $6, and he was outraged, so... There's been a kind of campaign against high prices in the city.
But you could find that. You can find just as expensive toast here in London, I think.
Yeah, maybe. A single slice of toast for, what would that be, 10 pounds?
10 pounds. But luckily we get free fresh baked bread here at Midori House every morning.
Luckily, yes.
Luckily. Well, Danny, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
With a look at the US papers.
And that's actually already all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Ale John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mati Aligaya. And our studio manager was Sam Impey. Up next after the news is Section D with Tom Morris. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London, 7 a.m. in New York. But now, from me, Markus Hippi.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening and have a great weekend.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dared men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.